Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is pretty laser focused.
It is.
We are diving into the earliest historical documents of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, really just that Joseph Smith period from about 1830 to 1844.
Right.
And we're here to figure out the original meaning and, more importantly, the application of the skin of blackness teaching that you find in the Book of Mormon.
And this is such critical work because you have to understand this to get the intersection of race and theology in this tradition. I mean, the Book of Mormon, as it was first published, it describes a divine curse.
Mm-hmm.
God gives the Lamanites dark skin for a very specific reason, to make them look wicked and filthsome and dark and loathsome to the white Nephites.
And what we're trying to do today is contrast that, you know, that very clear historical understanding with the narratives that the modern church and its apologists are pushing today.
Exactly.
Because we've seen this wave of efforts, especially from groups like Book of Mormon Central. They're targeting missionaries, investigators, mostly on platforms like TikTok.
Yeah. And in private channels, too, there's this group, the Cavalry, which sort of operates like an internal PR team, giving out these pre-vetted copy-paste answers to members.
And the goal of this modern movement seems pretty straightforward.
It is. It's to claim that the skin of blackness was never a literal physical thing. They argue it was symbolic, maybe paint, tattoos, animal furs, or just spiritual death.
An argument that, as you've pointed out, kind of actively ignores decades of institutional racism. And more than that, the actual lived experiences of countless Native Americans and Pacific Islanders.
People who were told for generations that their dark skin was a literal sign of this curse. It creates this huge intellectual tension.
Okay, so let's unpack the modern apologetic strategy first. It kind of gives us a roadmap for our own historical analysis. If you're hearing these claims today, they usually come in three parts.
The first one is all about symbolism. They argue skin of blackness is just a metaphor for spiritual death. And to prove it's not some modern reinterpretation, they point to ancient texts.
Right. You'll often hear them cite the biblical Book of Lamentations. It talks about the destruction of Jerusalem and has the phrase, visage is blacker than a coal.
Mm-hmm. And they also bring up an Assyrian treaty from Esarhaddon in the 7th century BC, where the curses say things like, may thee be black as pitch and crude oil.
So the argument is, Joseph Smith was just using this old established idea where blackness means destruction or spiritual death.
The second claim is a bit more complex. It's about a textual change.
Okay.
Apologists will highlight that in the 1842 edition of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith changed 3 Nephi 2.15. The phrase white and delightsome became pure and delightsome.
And they argue this shows the focus was always on spiritual purity, not skin color.
Right. And the final piece of their argument is that, you know, at the end of the day, the Book of Mormon is an inclusive book. They'll point to verses where God invites black and white, bond and free, and say the few tricky passages on race are outweighed by this bigger universal message.
But when you start to critically analyze those specific claims, the whole strategy, it starts to fall apart pretty quickly.
It really does. Take Lamentations. If you actually read the text, the darkness described there is consistently tied to physical suffering.
From famine and siege, right?
Exactly. People are dying. Their skin is described as hot as an oven. It's clinging to their bones because of starvation. It's about a physical state of suffering.
And that context is everything. The Bible is talking about the consequences of a siege, not a curse put there by God to identify a wicked people to a righteous one.
It's a completely different context. Mm-hmm. The Book of Mormon's curse is an identification marker put there for distinction and separation.
Okay, so what about the change from white to pure?
Well, this is where the apologists kind of create a self-defeating argument.
Mm-hmm.
They often claim the Book of Mormon had no real major changes, yet here they are, highlighting a massive theological change made by the founder himself.
So what does that tell us?
It suggests the original word white was seen as problematic enough by Joseph Smith or someone to need a major edit. That completely undermines the idea of a stable, unchanged text.
And the inclusivity argument, that seems to hit a wall too.
It does, because while you do have those universal passages, the main narrative demands that one specific group, the Lamanites, has to have a literal physical curse removed first before they can come to God.
That precondition, that need for a physical change, it just completely rejects the idea of true racial unity in the story itself.
So if these modern arguments are built on, you know, cherry-picked sources and a denial of textual history, we have to go back to the 1830s, What did the founders themselves actually teach?
And this is where we get away from interpretation and look at action. And they had, I mean, almost zero confusion about who the Lamanites were.
None at all.
We have a letter from Joseph Smith himself, January 1833, to a man named N.C. Saxton. And in it, he says, the Book of Mormon is a record of the forefathers of our Western tribes of Indians.
And that message is just consistent across the board. You have Oliver Cowdery and others. When they're talking to Native American groups like the Delaware Indians, they're saying, this book is the history of your ancestors.
The Lamanites were, without any question, the Native Americans of North, Central, and South America.
And that's why, right after the book was published in 1830, they immediately organized missions to the Lamanites.
The famous ones, to the Seneca and Delaware nations.
Because the book was written for them, the prophecy, the expectation, was that they would hear this, recognize their history, leap for joy, and just instantly join and lead the church.
But that's not what happened.
Not even close. It failed almost immediately. Very few Native Americans converted, and almost none took on leadership roles. So the prophecy didn't match reality.
And the church leaders had a crisis on their hands. How do you keep the story going that prophecy is being fulfilled when it's just not?
And that failure led to some, let's say, very questionable internal moves. Most notably, what historians now call the DNC codename deception.
Right. So in the early editions of the Doctrine and Covenants, these are the published revelations. Joseph Smith starts putting in code names for prominent white leaders.
Names like Zambre, Momsum, Sheet or Lomuk. And they appear in the sections about organizing the church, about stewardship.
Well, hold on. If the main reason was to hide, say, financial liability from the Kirtland Bank problems, why put it in scripture? Why not just use pseudonyms in a ledger? Why alter the DNC?
That's the key question. It had a dual purpose. Yes, it was absolutely about hiding financial exposure. That was the worldly motive.
But the other motive?
Prophetic damage control.
Right.
By putting these names in the revelations, it looked to the members like Lamanites were taking up these prophesied stewardship roles.
Right.
But in reality, those names were just code for white leaders like Oliver Cowdery and Frederick G. Williams.
So they were using what was presented as divine revelation to manage a financial crisis and a crisis of prophetic failure. They were basically tricking the membership into thinking the Book of Mormon promises were coming true.
It really makes you question the nature of revelation in that very early period.
Okay, so if the failed missions and the code name aren't enough to show the curse was taken literally, this next piece of evidence is maybe the most direct refutation of the modern symbolic claim.
This is where Joseph Smith encourages intermarriage, specifically to achieve racial whitening.
And it connects right into the earliest signs of polygamy in the church, all centered on this Lamanite narrative. We have to look at the 1831 W.W. Phelps letter. It recounts a revelation Joseph Smith had.
And in that letter, Smith declared that the saints should,
quote, take unto you wives of the Lamanites and Nephites, that their posterity may become white and delightsome, because their females were, quote, more virtuous than the Gentiles.
Just stop and think about that for a second. This is the founding prophet, a year after the book is published, describing a command for intermarriage.
And the goal isn't spiritual purity.
No. The stated theological outcome is a literal physical transformation of skin color to become white and delightsome.
That just makes the modern claim that blackness was always symbolic or spiritual. I mean, it's just not historically tenable.
It's completely indefensible. The founder himself gave a revelation about marriage practices designed to produce literally white children from Native women. It makes the spiritual purity argument totally moot.
And there was a transactional side to this, too.
Oh, absolutely. The Ezra Booth account from 1831, he was a critic of the church, but he confirms that marrying Native women was seen as pleasing to the Lord, not just for theology. It was a workaround.
A workaround.
It allowed missionaries to get residency in Indian territory, independent of the agent who'd kicked them out before. So they were using this theological claim to get access to land.
So this Lamanite curse narrative was a political tool, a financial tool, and a sexual tool, all depending on what the immediate crisis was.
Precisely. It was this dynamic, adaptable tool, but it always, always centered on the literal physical curse of dark skin that needed to be fixed.
Let's look at two more cultural examples from that time that really cement this literal racial worldview. First, the Zion's Camp trek in 1834.
Ah, the Zell story. So during this march, Joseph Smith's group comes across a grave that had been disturbed. They find a skeleton and there's a broken arrowhead inside it.
And Joseph Smith, through revelation, immediately identifies him.
He does. He declares the skeleton belongs to a man named Zelph, who was a white Lamanite chieftain.
And the description is what's so critical here. Joseph said that Zelph's curse was taken from him and that he'd been killed in a great battle between the cursed dark Lamanites and the righteous white Nephites.
That one story confirms everything. It confirms the physical nature of the curse and its physical removal. Joseph finds a random skeleton and uses Revelation to say, this man was dark, but his curse was removed, so he became physically white.
The link between righteousness and literal skin color could not be clearer.
Not at all. And we see this same framework in the culture of the church, especially in their music. But to get that, you need to understand the 19th century mound builder myth.
This was the theory at the time that the really sophisticated mounds and earthworks you find all over North America couldn't have been built by the savage Native Americans.
Right. So they must have been built by some ancient superior white race that was later destroyed or just degenerated.
And the Book of Mormon in the 1830s slotted perfectly into that myth. The white Nephites built the civilization. The dark, cursed Lamanites degenerated into savagery.
And this worldview is just captured perfectly in a hymn from their first hymn book called Oh Stop and Tell Me Red Man.
This was in the official 1835 hymn book, and they sang it for decades, all the way up to 1919.
And the lyrics describe Native Americans as having idle Indian hearts who must quit their savage customs before they can be redeemed.
Idle Indian hearts, savage customs. That's the exact language used to describe the Lamanites in the Book of Mormon, and it directly supports the racist myth used to justify taking their land.
And just one last piece. In 1841, Joseph Smith meets with Chief Keokuk.
Mm-hmm.
The person recording the meeting noted that Keokuk had blue eyes. And in that cultural environment, this led to speculation, even by Smith, that Keokuk was a Lamanite who had the curse partially removed, again reinforcing this idea of a literal visible transformation happening in real time.
So when you pile all this evidence up, what's the conclusion? The historical record seems overwhelming.
It is. From the first missions to using Revelation to justify intermarriage, to the hymns they sang, Joseph Smith and the early leaders understood the skin of blackness as a literal, physical, dark curse, a curse that would be removed through righteousness and mixing with white blood.
And that consensus directly contradicts these modern efforts to soften the history, to say it was all just metaphor.
It does. And that denial does a real disservice to the generations of people who were taught that their own physical appearance was a mark of God's disfavor.
It's also clear that this whole Lamanite narrative was a really dynamic political and theological tool for them, and it shifted again after Joseph Smith died.
It shifted dramatically under Brigham Young. Mm. The focus moved away from conversion and intermarriage and moved much more toward colonization and conflict.
And that's a massive historical pivot we need to cover. So in our next deep dive, we'll get into that shift. We'll look at how Brigham Young's rhetoric hardened, how Native Americans went from being noble lost ancestors to just savage obstacles.
And we'll have to discuss the incredibly dark history of Mormons getting involved in human trafficking in Utah, buying Native American women and children, all in the name of civilization and assimilation.
It's a profound change from inclusion through conversion to later exploitation and colonization.
And that really brings us to a final provocative thought for you to consider. This history shows us that the Lamanite narrative changed based on the crisis of the day, a lack of converts, financial problems, the need for land.
So what's the question we should leave with?
Looking at this whole historical arc, what does the evidence suggest to you about the real function of the Lamanite teaching? Was it a spiritual doctrine, or was it a tool for managing practical worldly failures within the early church?
A question to hold on to. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.